industry I'd like to touch on, and something that's come up and I haven't made any submissions on, is capacity issues. In a general sense, any capacity issue that arises from action and an action plan that has circumstances change, and that is not under the control of the farmer, it's, I think, reasonable to have some sort of exception for that. I don't think it's appropriate that exception should be sought by way of resource consent, because for matters like unavailability of fences or fencing materials, things like that. And I've got through my 25 years of procuring fencing and realised there's only moments in time when I can actually do that sort of thing. So the sort of concept, I think there's, we need to get as much work achieved in the shortest time frame. So we need reasonably ambitious time frames, but we need an exception basis for that. And I see the exception basis as one of simply applying to council rather than through the resource consent process. So that's by way of introduction.
Thank you, Mr. Dale. Yeah. All right. Conway,
questions?
Good morning, Mr.
Dale. Good morning.
First of all, thank you for your evidence and your participation in the process. I know it's all been voluntary and you could have been enjoying retirement, perhaps a bit more, so thank you for that. It has been helpful. I just want to first ask some questions about stock exclusion.
Mm-hmm.
I noted that your evidence doesn't address the extent of the setbacks required. Is that because you don't have an issue with the council's proposed setbacks, or you just haven't focused on that?
I haven't directly focused on it. I do have... do have a view on setbacks, and that is I'm very keen on riparian fencing to exclude stock from stream banks and streams, but the setback is, I think, an overstated benefit. I refer to Dr. Dupree's evidence. We calculated the marginal benefits of going from 3 to 10 metres setback as being, in real world terms, I think something around 5% additional filtering. But then there's also the issue of stream bank erosion that is a very significant factor independent of that anyway. Going from 1 metre to 5 metres using Dr. Dupree's same calculation is only another similar 5% marginal benefit. But then I look at the evidence supporting that in the same report, more particularly the NIWA report of recent times, and perhaps I can make that available to the court, really describes the context of where those experiments were done. Most of them in North America, and we talk about things like usual pastoral situation, that of course grass filtering of pasture is not as effective as grass filtering of a freshly cultivated paddock, for instance. They also talk about the median rainfall, annual rainfall of those areas were was about half of what there was in the Waikato, and a significant effect there is that a lot of the trial results, there's a lot of infiltration going on, and basically sucking the water out as it went through the filter zone. I don't see that as a typical situation happening here. So for all those reasons, I think it's very overstated the benefits of setbacks.
Okay, maybe we'll take up the sort of the water quality aspects with the water quality experts when we get there. But you're aware of the Federated Farmers proposal for an average setback of 3 metres and a minimum setback of 1 metre?
Yeah.
And would you, if I understand that, that's to sort of enable fences to be kept a bit straighter without losing too much land? And do you sort of support having a bit of flexibility in that way?
Yes, I do. I've made some assessment of the riparian fencing I've done with no minimum setbacks, because it's done long before this stuff came out. The average on my property is 4 metres, so without specifying any minimum, most likely you're going to get quite a lot more. Certainly, there's places where I've had to put the fence right on the edge of the bank, because my watch at night couldn't touch points. Enable them to be further back from that. And in one case, my main access went right through beside there. So it's much better to get a fence up rather than have a minimum setback that precludes even fence at all. There's lots of practical reasons why you end up with having something like 4 metres, whether it's flood protection or whether it's fallen at the entrance stream, whether it's to place the fence on even ground, and then there's a lot of stock management issues where you tend to not create sharp little corners, for instance, in a paddock.
Are there any practical concerns about going as close as 1 metre? You mentioned you'd have to do it sometimes, but...
No, I don't think it's an issue at all, because the farmer will want to put it on ground sufficiently away from the edge of the stream to make it stock-proof. No, I don't see any issues with it.
Okay. But there could be a water quality concern, which we can take up with any expert when we get there.
Well, only if it's causing trampling issues right at that point, but I don't see trampling issues occurring just because of where a farmer would logically put it anyway.
Okay, I'll move on now to slope. The issue of a 10 degree slope versus a 15 degree slope. So, new evidence and cheek is, and you mentioned it in your intro as well, that slope above 15 degrees is generally accepted to be too steep to traverse with a tractor.
Mm-hmm.
And what are the sort of the on-the-ground issues that happen when you try and traverse those steeper slopes?
Stability, the tractor stability, basically. Most tractor-mounted post drivers are side-mounted at the rear, so there's a lot of weight hanging off the rear in one corner that adds to instability problems.
So it might tip over with the wheel spin, type of thing? Yeah, right. But about 15 degrees and below, these problems are less likely to occur?
Less likely, it's my mate, WorkSafe, their advice don't mention slope just because I suspect there's some different situations where it's safe on one slope, and depends on the the orientation of the tractor on the slope depends whether what I term that there's a run out available. So if you do get into trouble, lose traction, there's somewhere where you can run the tractor out onto a flat area. Often beside a stream, you're in the most dangerous position possible because it's in size down and you've got a steep bank to top or over.
Okay, but you're sort of your overall position is that you don't have an issue with the 15 degree slope threshold being used?
No, I think there's some exceptions there, and I've in my submissions I've talked about some exceptions there. I note that the combined industry group is going for 10 degrees. I, as a sole farmer representing myself and a retired farmer with no skin in the game at that, I don't wish to make a strong case for 15 degrees over 10.
Okay, and just in terms of the maps, the evidence raises issues with the accuracy of the MFE 10 degrees slope map, and in particular the resolution down to 15 metres is a concern for you. Do you have any issues with the use of a map in principle if a more accurate map could be produced using the LiDAR?
Yeah, well, certainly the LiDAR map that Council's got looks excellent to me. I'm very, very critical of the MFE map based on what it tells me on my phone. It's very inaccurate. It maps at 45 degrees slope, in some places there's low slope, less than 5 degrees. So it's extremely inaccurate, but the 1 meter LiDAR map actually locates the contours, where turning points of the contours locate the streams on the aerial photo below it very accurately. That gives me a fair bit of confidence that it's going to be a very useful tool. And what's more, the slope can be determined off the map with no further work. Quite easily, very simple map reading technique of slope is determined by the spacing of the contour lines. So it's pretty readily seen by scanning which areas are low slope, which areas are steeper, and measurement is probably only required in a few cases.
Thank you. So, could a practical solution be for you to take that LiDAR map, to use that as a default in these provisions effectively, which can be superseded by field measurements? Would that be a practical?
Absolutely. And if a placeholder needs to be put in place, because I suspect by the time a decision is made here, LiDAR will be complete throughout the Waikato. It's favoured you now, and I see it advancing week by week. I think that's probably can be used as the basis of this, these rules, but I still aren't comfortable of having it as the sole. I think there still needs to be the ability to ground truth it, and so the measurements on the ground is the one that finally determines what's possible.
Thank you. I just want to move on now to the 2 year time frame for getting stock exclusion work done, clause 4 of the of Schedule C. Mm-hmm. And you raise new evidence, various barriers to farms complying with this time frame. Cost, time, contract availability, supply of materials, mm-hmm. that type of thing. Are these factors specific to each farm and each situation, you think?
Some will be won't have much work to be done because they've already done it. Some will have a lot of work because they haven't done anything, and they will have the unfortunate position of having a lot of work to be done just because of where the contour of their land and the number of streams through it. Some respects it's specific, but when it comes to availability of posts or things and contractors, which will be much wider. And I keep asking things and contractors around me what their workload is before this kicks in, and invariably they say they are flat out. Fencing contractors advertising, there's plenty work coming at them, so I think that's a real constraint. There's been constraints in recent times on availability of posts. So the problem we face, I think, is that to put any time limit on it without any outs, there's none of us know what those constraints will be. So just like a commercial contract might have a best endeavours type clause or force and force majeure clause, there's no similar way so far in these rules to provide an exception.
Okay. So just to go back, I think you said some farms could comply and others couldn't, sort of a short summation of it. Do you think that if the 2-year time frame is extended, those farmers that might find it quite manageable to do it within 2 years, they may choose to defer their expenditure if the rules allow them 5 years?
Yeah, that's a good point. And yeah, maybe that would happen. That's a concern. There could be a requirement. I'm not sure whether it needs to be in the rules or whether the certifier can deal with it straight away, but there's a requirement for steady progress rather than to say 5 years you have to have it done, and that's right. The other point I'd make there is that I think, and I'll make it into my the issue of gaining experience is very important, and so farmers need to get on and make some progress so they learn rather than holding until the last minute and regretting that they've haven't taken some learnings out of it. Certainly in my years I've been doing it, I've learned on the way and I've modified my approach on that, and that's been a valuable sort of thing to do.
Okay, and just going back to that idea of steady process, do you think a practical solution could be to retain the 2-year time frame to ensure that those that can comply do comply, while allowing 5 years if it's not practical to comply within 2 years or something like that?
I think 2 years is extraordinarily incredibly short. I'd rather deal with it by having a more realistic time frame and expect steady progress along the way. I think that's a better way to frame a rule. The other point is that stock exclusion national regulations require those ways to be protected by, if not by now, the latest by July 2025. And they, under the regs, will to get a decent audit grade, they will have to be ticked off first. I think any PC1 rule
just going back to that 2-year time frame being extraordinarily short. It's short for some farms, but not all. It's sort of where we got to, isn't it?
In my case, I've done about everything anyway, so it's not short for me.
Yeah. I just want to talk a little bit about wetlands now. This is the last thing I want to talk about. So under evidence, you're opposed to splitting stock from wetlands down to 50 metres squared, which you say is too small. Can you just comment, in terms of your practical understanding of, on the ground on a farm, the extent to which on-farm wetlands are connected to rivers or streams in your experience?
Yeah, my experience is pretty limited to my farm and farms around me. That most that I'm aware of are very much connected to streams. In fact, some of the what probably could be classified as intermittent, you could say they down through their reaches oscillate between intermittent stream and wetland.
And would the fencing of those smaller wetlands that are connected in that way be more practical if they're connected to streams that are already required to be fenced?
In that respect, some of my concerns about fencing smaller areas, if they're connected to a water body that requires fencing elsewhere, some of the efficiencies of having light defences then become, it just becomes part of the fencing of the water body ground of wetland alone.
Okay. Thank you for that. That was very helpful. No further questions here.
No questions. Thank you, sir.
I wanted to talk to you today about maintenance on your farm, and you refer to that in paragraph 7 of your evidence. And were you here when Ms. Slater for Fonterra gave her evidence? She was the dairy farmer.
No, I wasn't.
Right, so she has 100 hectare grazable land dairy farming, and I think it was Mr. Hodges who asked her the question of maintenance on her farm and if she needed to undertake any maintenance to the fencing that she currently has, and she noted that it wasn't an issue for her. I just wanted you to talk through or explain your paragraph 7 there, where you seem to have maintenance issues from weather events, and why is that an issue on your farm?
That particular situation is I have at that stage 4 kilometres of my main stream fence. We had a weather bomb and virtually the whole thing was destroyed. It wasn't because it was in the wrong place, it was just in a situation where high up in the floodplain, a lot of the wetlands and the headwaters let go and came down in mudflows and wreaked havoc. To just clean up the mess took me about as long as to replace the fence. So that's a major issue in a flood risk area regarding maintenance, and some farmers are in a much more vulnerable position just because of the lot of their land than others, but that's a major, and it's something that will repeat in the future. At what very important. Otherwise, it's overgrown with weeds and birds can spill those weeds to other grasses, and that we're trying to establish trees and ripe riparian zones with the weed infestations I think the best way of thinking of an area that's not controlled for weeds is to observe all the weeds on roadsides out in rather steep country where often they're not controlled at all, and if we're not careful, we're inviting riparian zones to become like that in the future.
And in your experience, is the best way to avoid that issue by having this sort of setback?
To have a flood, to avoid flood damage.
After the weeds that you were just talking about.
Look, the bigger the wider the riparian zone, the greater the setback, the bigger the problem for maintaining the weeds. My neighbour's got convolvulus growing uncontrolled in the riparian zone, crawling over the hot ones and shorting them out, so they become ineffective as stop excretion at that point.
Thank you. And moving on to Schedule C, would you say that the current Schedule C and PC1 as we have at the moment is fairly complicated?
From a farmer point of view, so you're thinking of a farmer preparing his own farm environment plan, right?
Looking at Schedule C, the minimum standards, so being able to read that, go through it and understand how it applies to their farm.
Yeah, I think the whole preparing a farm environment plan will be a very daunting sort of process for a farmer to take Schedule C and look at the whole structure of the rules, look at understand the national regulations, with the stock exclusion regulations or farm plan regulations, and the NDS regulations. For a farmer to find his way through that without some assistance will be a tool.
And there is now an amended version by the farming sector, you called it, for Schedule C. Would you say that, in your opinion, has simplified things?
I think there's some useful, complicated things in there in terms of defining what should be what strings should be included and what shouldn't be.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Pinnell. No further questions.
Federal funds?
No, thank you, sir.
No. Brothers isn't here. Song,
no, thank you.
Thank you. Horticulture New Zealand?
No, thank you.
No, thank you. River Ely, Mr. Pooh, hello. Thank you. Ewe not here. Hello, proudly present. There are any questions? I don't know. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Pinnell.
Can everyone hear me at the back?
That's good, thank you. First of all, thank you very much for your evidence, because it is very, very helpful to the court to understand from someone who works the land what matters and what works and what doesn't. So thank you for that. It's very helpful indeed. You've covered a lot of the issues that I wanted to just clarify a few things with you. And one of them is critical source areas. And you said that you support the change definition that Federal Farmers are recommending. And that certainly seems to me to go further than the current regulation in PC1. But we've heard many different views of what critical source areas include, including tracks along fences and headwater areas, standing areas for stock, these kind of things. Do you think that everyone will have the same understanding of the Federated Farmers definition, but that includes all of those things.
To what extent do you push into those areas is a big issue. While the Federated Farmers submission narrows what constitutes a critical source area, and I support that for two reasons. One, it's totally impractical as the rule stands now, because some of my paddocks would be sliced and diced about a dozen times with critical source areas using the definition as now. And that's just standing back and looking at counters, identifying swales and gullies. If I'm out there while runoff events are going on, I will discover a lot more critical source areas as defined in the rules. So, from a practicality point of view, it needs to be narrow. From an effectiveness point of view, I think it also needs to be narrow because we need to concentrate on the low hanging fruit. So, let's get to where we can see some contaminant issues of potential get washed off with its areas or whatever. There's so much discretion in what the certifier can look for and identify. And the rules and a lot will depend on how they're applied in practice. I can't see that the rules can get going too much further than where Federated Farmers is going, but I'm worried about where it will end up. And I think my evidence suggests that there needs to be farm industry input as well as other stakeholder input that goes into the training of certifiers. Because I think somewhere there needs to be some consistency between farms and between certifiers have been approached this and to find some sort of balance between practicality and good outcomes. How that's done is still a mystery to me.
That's helpful, thank you, and sort of confirms that there is an issue that we need to think about a little bit more. And I wonder, bearing in mind that PC1 is the first stage of a long process, would there be any advantage in picking up on what you just said, that first priority must be given to obvious sources of runoff, something like that, and then it can be picked up in later plan changes once that's been done? Is there some merit in that sort of thing?
I think so.
Thank you very much. Now, you mentioned the NIWA guidelines. Are those the 2022 guidelines that you mentioned in your...
Specifically, it's the report that supports those guidelines.
Okay. Yeah. I certainly read the NIWA guidelines, but I haven't read the report.
I found it very informative.
If you could make that available, I'd certainly appreciate that. I think it would be helpful. And I'd just like to understand your experience a little bit more, because you've obviously thought about this a great deal. And we're getting evidence on the water quality side that it's fine sediment that is something that has to be addressed. And we've also had evidence that you need to be up at the sort of 5 to 10 meter distance to be more effective at that. And there's also the issue of buffer strips as opposed to just plain grass. In your best experience, given the issues we're dealing with here, Hill Country Farms and various things like that, do you have a view on whether, you said 10 metre maximum, I can understand that, you think there is a case for going to 10 metres in some cases, in all cases, or it has to be dealt with purely on a case-by-case basis?
What I'm saying there is that there's a 10 metre margin of which you can you find an accessible fence line within that 10 metre margin. In terms of effectiveness, I think make 2 points. One, I've done in the past quite a lot of measurement with turbidity tubes during flood periods, and in our catchment, that's generally starting off in a paddock where there's runoff happening. The sediment measurement is quite low, and as I follow it down through the mainstream, it just gets larger and larger in terms of sediment flow. And that, in my view, when I see stream banks falling in, it's the stream bank stability issues are a major issue in our catchment. So then coming back upstream, how do we deal with it? We've got the major problem of filtering inefficiency resulting from concentrated flows. And so all these critical source areas, as per how it's defined now, are basically erosion channels anyway. So once any contaminant gets into there, it's unlikely to deposit because the erosion channel has historically done exactly what it eroded out. So it comes back to, I think, the greatest gains is to how you actually manage your pastures and reduce pain and keeping a good soil and grass there. So I think that's the key issue that we can influence, and I see over my farming career how a lot of improvement has happened there. It was 40 years ago, it was very much a conventional thing, but there'd be a lot of pain on farms, dairy farms in particular. I can blame my side of the fence during those periods, but that practice has been improved a lot, and I guess there's some improvements still to be had there, and I think that's probably the key way of addressing, keep trying to keep contaminants out of your place.
Okay, thank you very much, that's helpful today. You mentioned the issue of realistic time frames, and that's something I mentioned before, but trying to make sure that it's not so rigid that farms say, well, I will, because I can't achieve it anymore. Do you have you mentioned the regulation setting time frames. They say that things like excluding dairy stock, if the commencement date is about now or quite recently, so they don't actually state, from what I can see, a time frame by which compliance is required. Is that your understanding or not?
My understanding is for various types of farming that has got different rates. For low intensive beef, for instance, I think it's July 2025.
Yeah, well, just to be a little bit more specific, Regulation 9, which relates to dairy cattle, for example, the commencement date in relation to that, if our new pastoral systems, is the commencement date for new pastoral systems on the 1st of July 2023. I'm not sure if that means that everything's got to be finished by then, or that's when it starts to apply. And I guess this is a legal question, but it wasn't clear to me, but Okay, well, in that case, so really everyone should have, all dairy farmers should have done all the... Yeah, okay, thank you.
That's my answer.
Okay, look, that's fine. And in terms of priorities for streams, what would your preference be? Because we've heard evidence that grain should be fenced, ephemeral streams should be fenced, white streams should be fenced, lakes should be fenced. Do you have any view from a practicality point of view in terms of getting the best improvements most quickly? Where would you suggest the priority comes?
Well, you yourself mentioned also the possibility of doing the lower slopes first and then moving into higher slopes. I think that's something that I'm attracted to, and certainly the other way of addressing it is I've put greater priority on training the streams as one streams, and the females, I've certainly got the view that they can't attract the defence. But I think on balance, I prefer your approach of doing the easier country first for the reasons I explained before, getting some experience. And that might broadly relate to have some correlation between this and the driver at the same time.
Thank you. First of all, it isn't my approach, I'm just exploring it.
Sorry, I'm jumping the gun.
Yes, no, and really this is an information gathering stage.
Yes.
So there's a lot to think about in this case. Do you have any experience with the nitrogen risk scorecard through your involvement with other
No.
Okay, thank you. You have expressed concern about the heavy reliance on stock units for, in terms of fencing streams. On your own property, if the 18 stock units or whatever the figure is has to apply, how different would that be to what the regulations require anyway?
This is the paddock stocking rate?
Yes.
Yes. Well, it's a whole new additional layer to the regulations, and it would really make my farming operation as it was. Very, very difficult because I want to retain the ability to rotational graze for most of the year. The section was set on my ewes at that time, but for the rest of the year, it's very important to rotational graze for good grazing management. For stock health, because I had sheep and cattle, and the stomach worm problem can be reduced by having sheep from cattle from sheep. So for a lot of reasons. And the other main reason is if there's some paddocks that were just set stock and others rotationally grazed, I wouldn't be able to find my way around the jigsaw and paddocks with the moving rotationally grazed cattle through paddocks that were set stock.
Yeah, I did understand the concepts we were talking about there. I guess what I'm trying to understand is if the regulations require you to fence the stream or to stop excluding the stream anyway, what difference does it make? What PC1 is
Well, it's only the additional streams that PC1 require stock exclusion that apply.
Okay, so on your farm, do you have an idea of what that extra
length
is?
I'm always puzzled by the stock exclusion regulations of saying 1 metre minimum within a parcel of land. So what does that mean on my farm? That means my main stream is over a metre wide and all my I'm sorry. If the rule was applied and said only streams that are wider than 1 meter that paddock, then there would be a whole host of other small side streams that piece of one that was in, and I stepped up all those. On my farm, that didn't, because all of those are steep, wouldn't match the roof that we had in the wall.
Okay, that's helpful, thank you. How do you think other farmers are doing in the same area? Would they have been as diligent as you would be in terms of fencing some of the sports? Or don't you know?
I think a whole variety from I am to nothing. A lot of them are waiting to see what PC1 produces, I think.
Okay, that's fine. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Mr. Pennell, driving up and down state highways, one sees that the New Zealand Transport Agency undertakes quite a bit of drainage work around the highways.
Mm-hmm.
And they appear to increasingly, I haven't sort of noticed it as much, but it occurred to me, they appear to be increasingly reinforcing swale type areas, what might be critical source areas, using rock essentially, not terribly large. And I just wonder if rather than fencing, including virtual fencing of some of these areas, would it make any sense on a farm to reinforce the beds of, say, intermittent streams or some ephemeral critical source areas. I'm not saying everything, I'm not saying cover your paddocks and rock. But would it make sense to reinforce some areas so that stock could still cross, but that the capacity of them, as you describe it, to be conveyor belts for settlement would be reduced?
Mm-hmm.
Or is that headed in the wrong direction?
Horses and courses, I think.
Right.
I think there's for critical source areas, there could be opportunities like that sometimes. I don't see it so much for streams because my ones at least are on the alluvial flats, steeps highly. Very loose and consolidated material that wants to fall and dissolve.
Right.
And then my headwater streams are deeply incised,
right,
on quite different geology and quite firm in themselves.
Okay. We had circulated to us Mr. Hurst's farm environment plan. Did you have a look at that? Does that strike you as a typical farm environment plan for a mixed farm? Mixed cropping and dry stock?
I've got very little knowledge of Canterbury mixed cropping, but from my business, yes.
Yes, all right. And I'll be asking him some of these questions as well. It appears, and we had something similar week before that in relation to this. Would you expect that to be a reasonable level of detail for farms in the Waikato?
I was asking myself the same sort of question, I think. I haven't got a firm view, but I suspect probably, yes.
Mm. it does seem as though it goes into a lot of, if you like, underlying conditions, soil types, etc., in order, and fairly, appears to me, fine-grained approach to the treatment of different paddocks, doesn't it?
Yes, it's probably appropriate for problem.
Right. Not so much for pastoral farm.
No, I don't see that there's so many levers that you can put in a pastoral farm situation.
You're very different. Fertilizer and irrigation structure, I suppose, wouldn't it?
I suspect the nature of dry stock environment planning will look quite different to that.
Okay.
But in terms of complexity and length of the document, may not be too much different.
Right. Quite a bit of the document appeared to me to be restating things that are in the relevant Canterbury regional planning documents. And initially I wondered about whether that was simply bulking it up. But then I thought perhaps that's a useful thing because it means that the farmer has, in a bespoke document, the relevant plan provisions or relevant plan guidelines to remind the farmer of the way in which they should approach things for compliance with the relevant planning rules. Do you see that as helpful or a hindrance to have that extra information of that kind in the document?
Yeah. It's a very information-intensive process. The action plan should actually go through and give the result at the end. How much you need to have that front loaded is questionable. But I think it's important that the farmer is engaged and aware of why the action.
Why we're doing it.
Thank you very much. Anything arising else to call the question?
No. Thank you very much for your evidence, Mr. Pennell. Very helpful. You're excused.
Provided submissions for Lockyer Farmlands Limited, and I thought it would be useful to just provide a bit of context for the position that Lockyer has taken through these proceedings. They're, through the owners and chief executive, very supportive of a farm environment plan approach. And the approach throughout in the negotiations, first of all, as part of the actual hearing, PC1 hearing process, but then more so through this appeal process, through the negotiations, then through all of the mediations except for the critical source area, mediation, and then Mr. Robinson's participation in the caucusing, the farm expert caucusing, that the emphasis has been on trying to work through how that farm environment plan approach can work in a practical way, but not advocating for the status quo. And Mr. Robinson has provided some updated evidence, which I've pre-circulated. And it became apparent that in our desire for Lochiel to be supporting essentially the Federated Farmers' position and the Regional Council's position. So they've been in an interesting position throughout, in that the vast majority of Plan Change 1 is actually supported by Lochiel. And at the outset, I'd like to congratulate the Regional Council on their efforts to achieve a document that gives effect to Te Tiri Whaimana and also can be workable. And I'd also like to congratulate the Federated Farmers for the efforts they've made in trying to collaborate with all parties to get a practical outcome. But this is a pretty costly and time-intensive process. So for a single farming appellant, even though it is a big farm, it's been a real commitment from Mr. Robinson in time and from the farm in financial commitment. So the evidence that we've provided focused on the things that he sees as being difficult, given that the vast majority of it is pretty good. Inadvertently, that approach may have left omitted some context for the farm, because it has focused on the bits that don't work, and there's no context in there. And that's why I've provided some additional comments in the updated evidence from Mr. Robinson, which actually gives a bit of that context. Normally I would do that through leading witness in the submissions, but we have a lay witness who's very nervous. And we also have a situation where multiple expert witnesses have provided updated evidence that has varying degrees of updating. Lochiel also supports the most recent version of Plan Change 1, the one that has been now tabled from the farming sector group. Having said that, Lochiel supported one that came through with submissions from the Regional Council, with only a couple of omissions, and those respects related to the timeframes, the practicalities of that, the ephemeral, well, the 50 square metre waterways, wetlands, and then if that updated version wasn't accepted, the ephemeral waterways. So those are the key elements that are really quite problematic for Lochiel. In terms of where this goes, I'd like to support the comments from Mr. Trebilco about the fact that whatever the decision of the court is on this, it's going to have to be something that is sold out in the community to be workable. And in my submission, the farmers that have participated through this process, Mr. Pennell, Mr. Robinson, Mr. Cameron, and others that have been here, Mr. Berry, they're the ones that the parties are going to need, if they haven't run out of energy, to be collaborating and to be basically selling this outcome in the in amongst the community. I just note Mr. Robinson's updated evidence in terms of context for Lochiel. It is a hilly property with a variety of pasture types. It's over 3,600 hectares, which is relevant when you have in mind Miss Lattery's dairy farm of 100 hectares. The farm falls into catchments with 3,500 hectares in the upper Mercer, I think it is, catchment, and a small amount of about 120 hectares in the Whangapae catchment. And Mr. Robinson's updated evidence refers to those stocking rates that occur on Lochiel. So you're talking about a winter cattle stocking rate of about 6. And the biggest any time stocking rate being about 30. And as his evidence says, that's relevant to the type of topography on the field. I've referred in my submissions as an analogy to the Health and Safety at Work Act. And not because I think we could directly do that, but it is an example in New Zealand's legislation of where you have an outcomes-based piece of legislation that requires businesses to achieve outcomes, and they're required to do that through their own individual plans. And yes, there are central government regulations that come in on top of that, for example, scaffolding regulations, and there's numerous other bits and pieces. But for an individual industry and an individual workplace, they're expected to do that through their own health and safety plans and to work out what the hazards are and to achieve the outcomes that are required. And I suggest that is kind of the process that we're working towards here. There isn't a work safe that goes around, but there is a regional council, and they essentially have similar roles. And in my submission, it doesn't matter too much whether the regional council is tasked with monitoring and then enforcing permitted activity roles where the outcomes are not achieved, or the farm environment plan is breached, or whether they're having to do it through monitoring of resource consents, they're still going to have to do it. And it's still the same organisation. And in my submission, having a whole lot of detail in Schedule C about what's required in the farm environment plan and when becomes, it loses some of the point, which is that different farming systems, different farms, have different hazards and different priorities. And that was something that Plan Change 1 identified with the version that came from the panel, is that you have these categories of priorities and priority catchments. And now in the desire to achieve something that's going to work across the board for everyone, some of that's been lost. And I do have a concern that trying to end up with a document that is going to deal, make everybody happy, might not end up with the effect that it could have done if the focus was on what are the outcomes sought and what are the hazards and what are the areas of priority for each farm, and that could be done through the farm environment plans. In my view, the devil is in the detail. Some of that detail, you wonder how it will be applied by the processing officers, who tend to be the least experienced planners in the organisation. So keeping in mind that Mr. Trevilco and his team aren't going to be involved after this process, those rules and the criteria, they will be being enforced by council planning officers. We've heard from Ms. MacArthur and Mr. Robertson, Dr. Robertson, about the difficulties in determining what is and what isn't a wetland. And in my submission, I accept what they say. It's a technical process. So for many farmers where there is technically a pasture wetland, even though they're not applying the National Policy Statement definition, in practice, what is going to happen? And I wonder how much information, for example, Lock Hill, which is 3,600 million more coming up hectares, how much information would they need to be able to have to provide to demonstrate permitted activity standards? Or if they got tipped into controlled activity, what kind of reporting and information would be required for a controlled activity? Normally, the criterion that you don't comply with and therefore that you're not permitted, that's the thing that you would need to give evidence about. So if it was the ephemeral streams or the 50 square metre wetland, for example, then that is likely to be the information you would need to provide. And I worry as to just how much information would be required to satisfy that assessment.
Isn't that part of the issue? So that, from my perspective anyway, if you've got different people making different decisions in terms of plans, wouldn't you better to have a baseline then, from which, let's say, 80% would work from, rather than leaving that to the discretion of individual officers who may or may not have the same views as Mr. Trevilco?
Yes, Your Honour, for some things. But for that's why in my submission it's even more important that the area that baseline is at the right point. If it's too low, then you're going to catch everyone with huge amounts of information being required. And And in my submission, if the activity, if you're going to need a controlled activity consent, then you're going to be, if it's on the wetland issue, for example, the amount of investigation, the amount of evidence that would be needed to get an outcome where there are going to be conditions about fencing from the outset. So if you have a standard that says this is your baseline, unless through your farm environment plan you can demonstrate X, Y, and Z, in my submission, that you're already preempting what a likely condition is going to be. I bring the court's notice to the attention to Mr. Robinson's evidence that they've planted over 12,500 trees in the past 25 years. That is an ongoing proposal. That's not as part of any obligation. That's part of what the farm's been doing. Likewise, the water testing, not part of an obligation. In terms of looking at the detail of the sorts of concerns that I've set out in the submissions, I refer to Schedule D1, and it is Part 6B. There's been so many variations of this wording, but in my submission, 3 years for the infrastructure on a large farm, and most of the dry stock farms are large, so they may not be as large as Lockheel, you know, but most of them are large. To do that in 3 years is a big ask. There will be varying amounts of redesign and so forth to do. The weather events, you've heard evidence from various people about those. It's a fact of life, and it's probably not going to change too much. For Lockheel, it is still unclear whether it could get through as a permitted activity or whether it would be a controlled activity. I even read it, and I probably misread it, as potentially a discretionary activity. And that comes back to looking at the words and then following the outcome. If, for example, we look at Rule 3.11.4.4, so at the moment, the 50 square metre wetlands would probably catch Lockheel, so let's go straight to the control activity rule. And if you look at 4A, dry stock farming greater than 17 stock units, so that's not Lockheel. So then you go to 4B, dry stock farming winter stock rate is equal or less than 17, yes, or the cattle winter stocking rate is equal or less than 13, yes. And then underneath there's a sentence. I'm assuming that sentence, which says, but which cannot meet the stock exclusion standards in clauses 1 to 4 of Schedule C, I'm assuming that sentence is meant to apply to both A or B, A and B, as it's written, it looks like it only applies to B, but it wouldn't make sense otherwise because you could have a higher stocking rate and that wouldn't then apply. So I'm assuming there's meant to be a space there. If you then go to, it says, but which can't meet the stock exclusion standards in clauses 1 to 4 of Schedule C. So then I went to Schedule C and said, okay, we might have trouble with some of these in Schedule 3, 1 to 4. So then I went to 5. And 5 is your water body. So I've probably overthought it. But I wonder whether I might not be the only one that sees 1 to 4 and then goes to 5. And if you're in 5, then you're definitely fully discretionary. But I think it's just the way it's, probably just the way it's written. Maybe demonstrates the complexity of the drafting.
Now be a convenient time just to take a break in your submissions for morning tea.
Yes, John. I'm actually nearly finished anyway. But